Wow. Pretty full room here. It's really fun. I want to go ahead and get started because I have a lot of stuff prepared for you for the next 75 minutes. I'm going to have to run through this to get through it. So I'm going to move really, really fast, but I'm going to try not to skimp on any of the details. My name is Jeff Procise, as you can see on the screen behind me, and I'm going to enlighten you a bit about HTML5. Now, 75 minutes isn't a lot of time, but what I'm going to do is use that time as efficiently as I can to show you as many features of HTML5 as I can. I've got some slides. I've also got lots and lots of demos because I want you to know not only what you can do with this platform, but how you do it. And at the end of the presentation, I'm going to give you a download URL so that if you'd like a copy of all of these samples that I'm going to show, and in fact, of samples that I won't have time to show, you can go to that URL at your convenience and you can download all of these samples. Then you can take them back to work and claim that you wrote them, since I won't know any better. So with that, let's get started. Let me just say something right off the bat. Isn't it amazing what's going on in our industry right now? You know, in our little industry, about every 10 years, things change in a big way. I didn't see this coming a couple of years ago. I was so enmeshed in Silverlight and other parts of the Microsoft technology stack. If you had told me that 2 years from now I would be standing here and I wouldn't be doing a single talk on Silverlight or anything related to it, but that I would be talking about HTML, I probably would have told you that you were crazy. But HTML5 is taking our industry by storm. There's a lot of hype around it. There's a lot of misinformation. I want to show you what it is, and I want to show you the things that aren't so great about it as well as the things that are. My goal isn't to sell you on this technology, but to help educate you about it so that if this is something that you're thinking about investing in, you can make a more informed decision. Now, what is HTML5? Obviously, it's the new version of HTML, but to call it HTML is really to sell it just a bit short. In the old days, HTML wasn't much more than a markup language. If it were just the new markup elements in HTML5, we wouldn't care about it that much. What's really significant, and the reason there's so much buzz around this platform, is all the new features, all the new JavaScript APIs that allow us to do things in a browser without a plugin that we've never been able to do before. Do you want to draw directly into that browser from JavaScript? You can do that with the Canvas API. Do you want to play HTML5 video natively? You can do that as well. Do you want access to the file system? There's some support for that, and it just goes on and on and on. So while there is new markup in HTML5, that's not the big story. The big story is the new features, the new JavaScript APIs, and that's what we're going to be focusing on right here. Now, you may be interested to know, if you don't know it already, that there is no one specification called HTML5. Rather, it is a large family of specifications that is constantly evolving. Not only are the individual specifications, for the most part, one feature is one specification. Not only are they evolving independently, but new specs are being added. If you ask someone, what is HTML5, what the features are, you'll get different answers probably from each person that you ask. I put this chart together to give you my take on what it is, and I've divided these features into three different categories. On the left, in the blue blocks, you see the features that are pretty much universally supported now in HTML5 browsers. These are ready to go, even though the specifications haven't reached recommended status. Most of these are working drafts. They're unlikely to change much, and indeed a lot of companies are already deploying or have deployed products that use those features on the left. In between the green blocks, you have features that are almost ready. In fact, you could argue that they are ready. These are, by and large, more recent additions to the spec. There has been some flux in them, but they're fairly widely supported today. One reason I singled those out is they're not supported in IE9, which is an HTML5 browser. So if you choose to use those features today, be aware that if some of your customers use IE9, you're going to have to use polyfill, shims, or something to make up for that lack of features there. Out on the right-hand side, in the pink blocks, you see some of the most recent additions to HTML5. For the most part, no browsers implement these yet, but it does show you the direction that this platform is going. For example, today there is no API in HTML5 for touch. So if you wanted to build a nice, rich, multi-touch interface, You can do it with browser-specific extensions. You can't technically do it with HTML5. That will change because there are working groups now who are working on things like that, as well as on other things that we need for desktop applications that run in a browser and for mobile applications. If I'm back here doing the same talk a year from now, I'm sure I'll have a different chart. A lot of those red blocks, some of them at least, will have moved into the green, and there will be additional blocks, additional features not shown here that will have work will have begun on before then. So it's not one spec, it's a family of specs. It's lots and lots of different features. Many of these specs, by the way, don't say HTML5 anywhere in them. In fact, today, when any new feature is added to HTML, we generally consider that to be a feature of HTML5. Now, one of the things that you will have to deal with if you're going to use HTML5 is the fact that you have varying levels of support for it in different browsers. Even the so-called HTML5 browsers out there today, for the most part, none of them implement all these features. So it's very important to be able to detect at runtime whether the particular feature or features your application relies on are supported in the host browser. And there are two ways to go about that. One is, you can do that detection manually in JavaScript, and I'm showing a couple of examples of how to do that here. In the first example, it's how you detect whether your browser supports the Canvas API. Second example, I'm checking to see if the host browser supports the local storage API. Now, while there's absolutely nothing wrong with doing feature detection this way, there is a bit of a rat's nest there in that there are a lot of different techniques that you have to use to detect individual features in different browsers, which is why a little library called Modernizer is rapidly becoming one of the most popular JavaScript libraries on the planet. It's kind of like jQuery. It's free. It's open source. And it does two things for you. Number one, it provides a very simple and easy-to-use API for checking not only for feature support of HTML5, but for support for individual features of CSS3 as well. There's one other thing that Modernizer does for you. If you use the new semantic markup elements in HTML5, which I'm not going to cover here because we're looking at the big features, but if you use the new semantic markup elements, elements with names like header, footer, article, section, etc., instead of ordinary divs, that's fine in an HTML5 browser. But you bring those pages up in a down-level browser like IE6, IE7, IE8, older versions of Firefox or Chrome, and they're going to look crummy. In fact, the CSS, the layout, will probably be totally destroyed. You won't like what you get. By simply including modernizer.js in your HTML5 page, if that page is run in a non-HTML5 browser, Modernizer will fix that up so that the page will look the way you want it to look even in down-level browsers. So what does Modernizer do for us? Number one, it gives us an easy feature detection API for HTML5 and CSS. Number two, it provides support for those semantic markup elements new in HTML5 in down-level browsers. At least it makes them look like it does. So, very popular library. Now, I'm going to do something real quick, and I am going to make this quick because I have lots of demos. One of my favorite sites is one named HTML5test.com. Don't know if you've ever been there before, but it's pretty cool because it performs a series of tests on the browser that you are viewing it in. Shows you what the results of the tests are, and even assigns a numerical score. What's it testing? It's testing for HTML5 and CSS3 support. Here I'm running an IE9. I can scroll down through here. I can see exactly which features of HTML5 IE9 supports and which ones it does not. If I were to run this in Chrome, it would get a higher score because the most recent version of Chrome, which of course revs more quickly than IE does support a lot of features of HTML5. By the way, sometimes we knock IE9 a bit. IE10 is going to be a fantastic HTML5 browser. The team back in Redmond who's working on that is doing a bang-up job of it, and I'm going to use IE10 Platform Preview 2, which was the latest version that will run on Windows 7, in some of my demos here today. So HTML5test.com is one resource we use to figure out what the browsers that we intend to support and what they don't. But let's talk about some features. What's so cool about HTML5? Why are people so excited? One reason is because HTML5 browsers support the geolocation API. This is one of those blue blocks on that feature slide I showed you a few moments ago. It's supported just about everywhere. What it allows you to do, quite simply, is build location-aware applications. So if you wanted to build something like Urban Spoon on the iPhone or Bing Scout on the Windows phone, you want a one-time fix on that user's location so you can recommend restaurants and other things nearby, this API makes it very easy to do that. The cool thing about it, if you've never used location APIs before, is that you don't have to have a mobile device. You don't have to have GPS hardware. Information delivered to you via the geolocation API can come from three sources: GPS, Wi-Fi positioning, or on a mobile device with a cell connection, cell tower triangulation. This API gives you an easy way to get the information. It doesn't give you any way of knowing where the information come from, but you can sometimes infer that because it does give you information about how accurate the location data that it's giving you is. By the way, on each of these slides that introduces a feature of HTML5, you'll see these green blocks at the bottom. What I'm showing you there are which browsers today, which HTML5 browsers and which versions support this particular feature. So, quick look at this API. If I want to know where I am, I simply call navigator.geolocation.getCurrentPosition. That's an asynchronous method. It returns immediately, but once it is determined where I am, it calls the callback function that I provide in the first parameter. In that callback function, I get a bunch of interesting information. I get, for example, the latitude and longitude. If the data is coming from GPS, and only if it's coming from GPS, I also get altitude. With getCurrentPosition, you generally won't get values for speed and course, speed and heading, they call it here. But I'm going to show you in a moment a companion method named watchCurrentPosition, which allows you to track the user's movements in real time. That would be useful if you're building a navigational type application. And when you use watchCurrentLocation, those values will actually take on real numbers. Heading will be a value from 0 to 360. Corresponding to points on a compass telling you which direction a user is moving. Speed will be a value in meters per second telling you how fast they're moving. And when that data is coming from GPS, it can be very, very, very accurate. I said a moment ago that you can't tell definitively where the data is coming from, but there are ways to infer it. For example, if you get a value for altitude, that proves that the data is coming from GPS. You can also infer from the accuracy where the data is coming from sometimes. When you're getting the data from GPS, oftentimes that value will be in the range of 3 to 7 or 8 meters, whereas if the data is coming from Wi-Fi positioning or cell towers, it can be in the hundreds, even the thousands of meters. If you've never dealt with Wi-Fi positioning before, it can be scarily accurate, converting an IP address into a location. I haven't tried it on this box, on this network, but there's a chance, using nothing more than this cable plugged into my laptop here, I don't have cell hardware, I don't have GPS hardware, there's a chance that when I run this next demo, it'll pinpoint exactly where I'm standing in this building. We'll see. Now, you always need to take into consideration the fact that when you call getCurrentPosition, it may fail. Maybe the device that the browser is running on cannot determine where you are. It's not connected to a network. It doesn't have a cell signal. It has no GPS hardware, or the user is inside a room like this where we can't see GPS satellites. That's why when we call getCurrentPosition, we always like to provide a second callback function as well. We call that the error callback, and if for some reason the browser can't determine where we are, it will call this function rather than the first one. It will even pass information to the error function telling us why it couldn't get us the information. If you see position unavailable, that means the browser simply couldn't determine where you were. But if you see permission denied, here's what's going on. Every browser in the world today, before giving your program information about the user's location, will first prompt that user for permission for privacy reasons. If the user says no, the browser will not provide data regarding location to your app. What it will do is call the error function and pass in the flag permission denied. You might then remind the user, hey, if you want to use this app, since it is location aware, you're going to need to go into your browser settings or your phone settings or what have you and enable this service. A couple of other things before we look at an example. On mobile devices, GPS receivers are among the most consumptive devices inside that mobile device. They can really drain your battery. Most browsers on mobile devices will never, by default, go out and get location data from GPS. You have to tell them to do that. And here's how you do that. When you call get current position, there's actually a third parameter that you can pass in. It's called a position options object. And one of the options you can specify there is a Boolean field or property named enable high accuracy. If you do this, that tells the browser, regardless of what type of device it's running on, to use the most accurate data available to it, including GPS, if there is GPS hardware on board. One other thing that's really, really interesting to know about that third parameter is this. If you use a Garmin or a TomTom or some other navigational device in your car, you know that sometimes it can take it a minute or more to get a lock on three satellites. Same is true of get current position. There's no guarantee how quickly it's going to return or if it's going to return at all. So you might find it interesting to be able to specify a timeout. This is how you do that. In the third parameter to get current position, you pass this timeout interval. It's a value in milliseconds. All I'm doing here is telling the browser, if 10 seconds after I call this method, you still don't know where I am, I'm no longer interested. What the browser will then do is call that error function, the second parameter to get current position, and pass in a flag telling you that a timeout occurred. One final thing before we launch into the next demo. Get current position gives you a one-time fix on location. Watch current position gives you a continuous readout via a stream of callbacks. Now, most mobile device operating systems like iOS, Android, and Windows Phone have a location API built in, and most of them actually allow you some control over the frequency of these callbacks. HTML5 does not. You can't say, call me back once a second, or every time the user moves 3 meters like you can in native phone OSs. However, when you do call watch current position, what the browser does guarantee you is that with some regularity, it will call you back and let you know where that user is. What many browsers will do is they won't fire repeated callbacks if the user is not moving, but if the user is moving, they'll fire some callback each time the user has moved some unspecified distance. By the way, if you ever call watch current position, if it's using GPS, it's draining the battery on a mobile device, always, always, always save the ID returned by watch current position. And when you no longer need the data, cancel it by calling cancel watch as I'm doing right here. Now, let's try and see if that actually works. In fact, the only possible way the machine I'm running on could get a fix on its location is through Wi-Fi positioning. Let's see how accurate it is. So I'm going to go into Visual Studio here, and I'm going to open a solution named HTML5 Demos. This is the one that's in the zip file whose URL I'll give you at the end of the session. And I'm going to go into the location folder and run a little page named maplocation.html, which not only uses the HTML5 geolocation API to get my location, but also combines that with Bing Maps to provide a nice graphical representation. Now you can see here IE9 is saying, hey, this application wants your location. Will you allow that to happen? I will say yes one time. And now on Bing Maps, and I have no idea if that's where we are or not. Oh, it does say The Hague, so at least we're within a few miles here. Is that where we are? Okay, it's really good. And that's through Wi-Fi positioning. Now, let me tell you something here you may find interesting. Wi-Fi positioning, to some extent, is a black art. Companies like Microsoft and Google have these little groups they keep locked away in rooms with no windows that do clever things to make Wi-Fi positioning really accurate. I mean, how in the world can an IP address be translated into very accurate location data? Well, there are all sorts of things that these companies do. For example, if you carry an Android phone, you fire that thing up and connect to the Wi-Fi right here. And it has recently been used to get GPS location data. Unless you turn this off on an Android phone, that data is going right up to Google. It's being consumed inside their Wi-Fi positioning service so that they know when an IP comes in from that network, they may not know really where my box is, but they knew where your phone was when it was connected to it, and they can make this eerily accurate. Now, I'm actually using Microsoft's Wi-Fi positioning service here. That's what IE9 does. My guess is someone in this room is carrying a Windows phone and has been using the GPS on it in this area somewhere. By the way, if I were to run the same thing in Chrome, I may get very different results because they use Google's Wi-Fi positioning service. But since some of you, probably one or two of you, do carry Android phones, my guess is Google's going to be pretty accurate as well. Okay, so let's keep going here because we have a lot to cover. And I don't want to shortchange you. If you're not out of breath by the end of the session, I haven't done my job. Real quickly, if you walk up to a person on the street and say, tell me what you know about HTML5, what they're probably going to say is, I know it supports video natively, and indeed it does. I'm going to spend 3 minutes on it. It is true. If you want to do video in a browser, you no longer need a Flash plugin or a Silverlight plugin because you can do it this way. Declare a video element. Use its source property to point it to a video file. And then the browser will display, if you include that controls attribute as I've done, the video element along with the playback UI. That UI will vary a little bit between browsers, but not that much. If you don't want that browser to provide the UI, you want to provide it yourself, you can leave the controls attribute off. There's a full API around the video element that allows you to build that player. You can tell it when to start playing, for example, in response to a button click. A couple of quick facts about HTML5 video. It doesn't do nearly as much as Flash and Silverlight do. There is no support in HTML5 video today for digital rights management, for example. There is no support for real-time streaming of video, like Microsoft streamed the Olympics out of Beijing and Vancouver in 2008 and 2010 using Silverlight. That doesn't mean it won't come. There are groups working on that now, but for today, what HTML5 video will do is a buffered playback, or a progressive buffered playback, kind of like the Windows Media Player. This is supported by every major browser today. It's very easy to use. But there is a bit of a fly in the ointment here, in case you didn't know it. When the committee members started working on this specification a few years ago, their original plan was for there to be one video format supported by all HTML5 browsers, as well as one audio format supported with the audio elements. But unfortunately, that didn't come to pass. This is a platform, after all, that is built and designed by committee. And various members of the committee, including some big names like Microsoft, Apple, Google, some hardware manufacturers, and others, could not come to terms. You see, companies like Microsoft and Google and Apple have paid millions of dollars to license codecs like H.264. They wanted to see those licensing fees that they had paid leveraged in HTML5 audio and video. Other browser vendors like Mozilla and Opera don't really have that kind of cash laying around. They really wanted there to be a free codec. Google actually stepped in at one point and tried to be the good guy and sort of mediate by offering everyone else a free codec. But the problem is you never know whether a codec is encumbered by patents or not until it's tested in court. And if you're Microsoft, you get sued all the time. I sometimes serve as expert witness in court for Microsoft back in the States, so I occasionally get to see some of the lawsuits that are filed against them, and oftentimes it's just people or companies hoping Microsoft will write them a check to go away. They usually don't do that. If they think they're in the right, they fight it, which I admire a whole lot. Bottom line, there is no one way you can encode a video or an audio such that it can be played by every HTML5 browser. What you have to do is encode it at least twice. And then you have to multi-source the video element, as I'm doing here. What a browser will generally do now, when it sees this video element, it will go from top to bottom looking at those different video files you've pointed it to. Same goes for the audio element as well. In this example here, since the first one I list is an MP4 file, which is natively supported by Apple Safari, Google Chrome, and IE, the browser will ignore those other child elements and go after that MP4 video. But when I bring the same thing up in another browser, like Firefox, for example, that doesn't support MP4, it'll go down and either use the WebM video or the AUG video. One little tip here. If you're going to use this and you think that this video might be seen on mobile devices, always, always, always list the MP4 file first. You know why? Because of a bug in the iPad version of iOS that causes iPads to ignore every child source element except for the very first one. If you want this to work on iPads, you need to list the MP4 file first. So, another thing you can do to help the browser out is add a codex attribute to each of those child elements. You see on the previous slide, I'm pointing the browser to files, and the browser might be able to infer from the file name extension what kind of file it is, but the truth is, file name extensions don't really matter. We could make them anything, right? Plus, for a given file format like MP4, which is just a container format, there are multiple audio and video codecs and profiles that could be used inside it. So what browsers have to do is download a portion of all or some of those files to read the header information, the metadata, to find out if they can support what's inside it. By being very explicit in what video and audio codec is being used in the file, you can prevent a browser from having to needlessly waste bandwidth and have to download a portion of one of these video files just to figure out whether it can play it or not. Now, I'm not covering this in the slides, but you want to know something really funny? There's a method named canPlayType that you can call on a video element or on an audio element. It lets you ask the browser, do you support MP4, do you support MP3, etc., etc. There are three possible values that the canPlayType method can return. They're all strings. One is an empty string, which means no. The next one is maybe, and the third is probably. The browser will never tell you, yes, I can play something to go to that format. It will tell you maybe, probably, or no. So, now, as a practical matter, when the browser tells you probably, in all likelihood, it will be able to play it. But you know how browsers are. They cannot make up their minds sometimes. Now, here's another useful thing to know. Lots and lots of companies today are moving to HTML5 video. YouTube's doing it. They have a dedicated HTML5 video site now. What a lot of companies run into, though, is, wait a minute, if I move to HTML5 to show my video, what happens if a customer brings this page up in an older browser that doesn't support that? Here's what we do. It's a clever little fallback mechanism. We embed inside that HTML5 video element an embed or object element that creates a flash video player or a Silverlight video player. What happens is, in an HTML5 browser, it knows that element doesn't belong inside, so it ignores it. But when this same HTML is parsed by an older browser, it has no idea what video in angle brackets means. It skips right past it, but sees that object or embed element and obligingly creates that flash or Silverlight video player. So this is how we have our cake and eat it too with HTML5 video. Now, I want to show you a quick example of HTML5 video actually playing, and also tell you something very, very important that's often overlooked, but that will drive you crazy if you don't know about it. Let's make sure first that we can play a video. Now, this is an MP4 you're about to see play in IE9. Let me get it going here. Anybody recognize that aircraft? It's an F-16. So that's what I do for a hobby. I build very large scale model radio control aircraft with real jet engines in them. Now, let's see if that same thing will play in another browser like Firefox, which doesn't support MP4. And I think you know what you're going to see here. It's going to work because I've multiple sourced this video element. But let's just prove it. Here we are in Firefox. Can it play that same video? Yes, and you can't tell it from the outside, but it's actually playing an AUG version of that video. Same video. Let's see if we can get over here and see that thing fly by a couple of times. These things are just amazing if you've never seen them in person. There's a nice little slow flyby. Now let me show you real quickly what's inside this page here. This is all it took. Here's the video element. The controls attribute, of course, telling the browser to provide that playback UI. And you can see that I've multiple sourced it. This is what IE, Safari, or Chrome plays. This is what most other browsers will play. By the way, If you, like me, work mostly with Microsoft products, you probably have multiple tools at your disposal for creating MP4 videos, but you may not have tools at hand to convert MP4 videos into OGG videos. There's a free plugin for Firefox named Firefog, which is just awesome. It's kind of like Expression Encoder from Microsoft. In the form of a browser plugin, it will convert those videos for you. It will also convert audios. Very, very handy tool and completely free. Firefog for Firefox is what I use to create these OGV videos. So, I told you I'd take 3 minutes on that. I took a little bit more than that. That means I will have to go faster to get through all of this. But you haven't seen the good stuff yet, folks. I'm saving the good stuff for the middle and the end. Next to video, probably the best known feature of HTML5 is the Canvas API. Now, I could literally teach a day-long session on everything you can do with Canvas. Obviously, we're not going to do that here. What I am going to do is spend maybe 10 minutes showing you the basics of Canvas and showing you some really, really cool things that you can do with it. What is the significance of Canvas? Because before the Canvas, without a browser plugin, we were never, ever, ever before able to use JavaScript to draw directly into a browser window. Today, you can declare one or more canvases in an HTML5 web page, and each of those canvas represents a drawing surface. You can use the Canvas API to draw anything you want to on that surface. Now, if you've never seen that API before, you're about to see it, or parts of it, be aware that it's kind of primitive. It's not like OpenGL or Direct3D or XAML or SVG. It is a very simple immediate mode as opposed to retain mode graphic subsystem. If you want to draw a line, you call a method to draw a line. Actually, you do several things before you call the method. But the fact remains, even though it may feel a little primitive to folks who do a lot of graphics programming, at least we can finally now draw into that browser window. Also widely supported in HTML5 browsers and widely used in applications. If you've never seen HTML5 Canvas at work, here's a cool place to go to, www.worldsbiggestpacman.com. Anyone ever been there? They have an HTML5 recreation of the original Pac-Man game from the early 1980s. And they have a level editor so you can build and then submit for others to play your own levels. There are, I think, over 100,000 levels there now. Microsoft built most of it. It looks and feels like the real Pac-Man. It uses the Canvas API extensively to draw the grid, the Pac-Man character, the little ghosts and stuff, and it uses HTML5 audio to play the Pac-Man music. Now, I'm going to show you plenty of examples, but first let me prepare you with a few things that you need to know first. Canvas represents a surface upon which you can draw on that web page. You can declare as many canvases as you want. I'm going to show you one example where I have, I think, 14 or 15 of them declared. Before you can draw anything to that canvas, you have to have a rendering context, which you get by getting a reference to the canvas element itself and calling its getContext method. Interestingly enough, even though we call it the Canvas API, the canvas isn't the one that provides the drawing API. It is the rendering context, which is an object of type canvas rendering context 2D. Just to show you a couple of quick examples, what does it look like to use this API? Simplest thing you can do with it is draw a rectangle. What I'm doing here is getting a reference to the canvas that I've declared, calling getContext to get a rendering context that allows me to draw to the canvas, and then calling the StrokeRect method on that rendering context. That's one of about 20, 25 different methods you can call on a rendering context to draw something to a canvas. There's a stroke text method for drawing text outlines. There's a fill text method for drawing filled text. And there are a bunch of properties that you can use on that rendering context as well. For example, if you want to draw a rectangle and you don't want every rectangle you draw to be a thin black border, you could change that border color to red by assigning the string red to the stroke style property of the rendering context. By the way, anything that's valid in CSS is valid as that in that stroke style property as well. If you wanted to change the thickness of that border, you could use the line width property of the rendering context. So you see, the rendering context is a state machine of sorts. It has properties that allow you to control the looks of what you draw and methods that allow you to actually draw things. There are also methods named, there's a method named fill rect, which lets you draw a filled rectangle. If you wanted to change its fill color to something other than black, you could assign a string like red to the fill style property. And you could even do things like this. In HTML5 canvases, we support linear and radial gradients. Very different from XAML and SVG, where we declare these gradients and then apply them to an object. Here we're doing everything programmatically. That is the nature of the Canvas API. One of the cool things you can do is this. You can call a method on the rendering context named createPattern. And you can do three things with it. You can paint with an image that you've loaded. You can paint from another canvas. That's sometimes used in more advanced scenarios where we want to do double buffered type animations. You can also pass into this method a reference to a video element playing a video. You know what it'll do? Create pattern will reach in, pull the current frame out of that video, and hand it back to you so that you can display it to the user. This allows you to use HTML5 video and canvas to create UIs in which the user can click a button or click a running video and pull clips out of it. Very, very cool stuff. Quick example or two right here. Let me just show you a couple of things regarding canvases. So I'm going to go into my canvas folder where you see I have lots and lots of samples. And I'll start with something simple. Probably the most common use for canvas today is just to draw pretty charts and graphs like this one. All I'm really doing here, I'm using that fill rect method to draw some red rectangles. I haven't shown you how to define and apply ink to paths, but there's an API for doing that. To draw those lines you see, I'm making calls to move to and line to, defining paths that are nothing more than lines. Then I call a method named stroke to apply ink to that path. And I'm also using transforms, which are similar to XAML transforms if you've used them there before, to rotate things in some cases. Notice on the vertical axis of that graph, I've rotated the text 90 degrees. I literally called rotate on that rendering context to rotate the entire coordinate system 270 degrees before I called fill text to draw the text. Then I restored the coordinate system to its original state before I went on drawing other things. I won't take the time to go through the code that does this. You can do that. But if that's something that interests you, you'll find a good example right there. How about this right here? Maybe something a little bit more eye-catching. So here's one of those puzzles where we take an image, we divide it up into pieces, and allow the user to click and move pieces around. I'm really good at scrambling these things. I'm terrible at putting them back together. In fact, I'm probably over my head right now. I can never get back to where I was. Now, let me tell you a little bit about this app. This app has one image. When it starts up, I use the Canvas API to cut that image up programmatically into a bunch of little squares, each measuring 150 pixels square. Each of those squares you see is actually a separate canvas. So in my code, I cut the image up, draw a piece of that image onto each canvas. Then I use jQuery to register a click handler for each of those canvases. And each time a canvas is clicked, I check to see whether the canvas that was clicked is adjacent to the empty square. And if it is, I use jQuery animations to slide that piece up, down, left, or right. Give you a quick look inside here. The HTML DOM in this page is pretty simple. Here are all of those canvases right there, each representing one square in the puzzle. By the way, two tips regarding canvas. To save you a lot of time pounding your head on the desk, and I know this the hard way, when you declare a canvas, never use a shortcut for the ending. Always have an explicit closing tag for a canvas. Otherwise, I guarantee you, you'll be very, very sorry. The second thing, and this cost me a couple of hours this past weekend. When you want to dimension a canvas, it's not enough to dimension it through CSS. You must explicitly assign width and height values to that canvas if the canvas is to behave properly. There are all sorts of things that go wrong if you don't do that. So remember, always have an explicit closing tag for a canvas. Always, if you want to fix its width and height, use explicit width and height attributes, as I've done right here. Otherwise, you'll get really wacky, almost inexplicable results, as if the canvas is using some alien coordinate system that you have no control over, which is effectively what it's doing. In the code up here, let me show you a little bit about what's going on. When this application starts up, here's my jQuery document ready handler. I do a quick check to make sure this browser supports canvases so I can warn the user if it doesn't. And if it does, I then load that image that you saw. And in this nested for loop, use the Canvas API, specifically a method named drawImage, to cut that image up and draw pieces of it onto each canvas. Then, with jQuery, I do a query to find references to all the canvases in the document, register a click handler for each, and when it's clicked, if I determine that I want to move that piece, I call jQuery's animate method to do that, even using these relative values you see here. And the end result is the application that you saw right there, just one more use for the Canvas API. But let me go back to the slides for a moment and say a little bit more about Canvas. I've always been a graphics nut. It was 3D graphics that got me into computers back in the early 1980s, and I still love graphics to this day. One of the things I really, really like about Canvas is the fact that it does give you access to the individual pixels in the canvas, meaning you can generate images from scratch, or you can load existing images, wrap a canvas around them so that you can read their individual pixels, and you can even modify those pixels. That means you can build Photoshop-type applications today using nothing more than HTML5, believe it or not. I want to show you a couple of examples, but first let me show you what that part of the Canvas API looks like. If I wanted to create an image from scratch, here's how you do it. You begin by calling on the rendering context you got from the canvas a method named createImageData. What that does is it returns to you a reference to an image data object that has a property named data, which is a single-dimensional array, or effectively a single-dimensional array, that has one item in it for each pixel in the image in row-first order. If you're familiar with Silverlight's writable bitmap class, it's very much like a writable bitmap and its pixels property. Now, what I can do now is walk through those pixels, assigning colors to each one to generate a random image or whatever I want to generate. And then when I want to draw those pixels that I've generated back to the canvas, I call putImageData, as you see me doing here. But you're not forced to create that image from scratch. You can always take an image you've loaded from somewhere and call, rather than call createImageData, you call getImageData. Now you get an image data object that is pre-populated with the pixel values from that image. You can read them, you can change them, and then if you want to show the user the results of your changes, again, you call putImageData to do it. I won't go deeply into it. Do be aware that most browsers by default will not allow you to see the pixels inside an image that came from another domain. Most browsers provide ways to turn that off, but that's generally, turning security off is not a good idea. This works fine as long as the images you're loading come from the local file system or from the same origin, which usually means same domain, that the page accessing that image came from. Let me show you a couple of examples here. And in the first example, you're going to learn something kind of interesting. By the way, I just realized something I forgot to tell you. Regarding HTML5 video, for most people, the very first time they try to do it, they try to show video in a browser using HTML5 video, it doesn't work. And let me tell you why it doesn't work. You must have enough control over the web server that serves up those MP4 files and AUG files and other video files or audio files if you're using HTML5 audio to control the MIME types going back in the content type headers and the responses. IE, for example, will request that MP4 file. And once the MP4 file starts coming down from the web server, if IE doesn't see a content type header in the response that says video/MP4, IE will completely ignore the video. And IE isn't the only browser that does it. Most do. It is incredibly important that you make sure that the proper content type headers are returned when you are serving up an HTML5 video. If you download and run these samples, you may notice that I'm not running against the ASP.NET development server. Rather, I'm running against IIS Express. That's because in order for that video sample to work, I had to be able to control the content type headers going back, and ASP.NET development server doesn't allow me to do that. IIS and IIS Express do. Now, I'm going to show you a couple of other Canvas examples here. And there's going to be something very revealing here. I have always been fascinated by fractals. I love the math behind it. When my kids complain, "Daddy, I don't know why we're learning about these imaginary numbers. I'll never use them in real life," I always sit them down and tell them about the Mandelbrot set. They still don't like imaginary numbers, but at least I feel I've done my fatherly duty. Now, this application here, its entire UI is nothing more than a canvas. which contains an image that I'm generating pixel by pixel when it starts up. And if I click to zoom in on a part of that very famous fractal, a new image is being generated right now, about a million new pixels, and in a moment, I'm going to see it come up. In a moment, I'm going to see that zoom. Ah, there we go. Now, what do you think about the performance there? Is that good? Took a long time, didn't it? Let me tell you a little bit of something that's going on here. It's tempting when you see that to think, well, that's JavaScript for you. After all, it's an interpreted language, right? Did you know JavaScript is no longer an interpreted language? Just about every browser in the world today JIT compiles JavaScript in much the same way that we JIT compile C#. In some cases, JavaScript is faster than C# today. Microsoft, with their Chakra JavaScript engine, is always tweaking and tuning to make it as fast as possible, and I'm sure Google's doing the same thing. But you know what? JIT compiling JavaScript is a very, very difficult thing to do, primarily because JavaScript is a typeless language. We can't look at the code and determine whether we're dealing with an integer, a floating point number, a string, or what have you. It just so happens that different browsers optimize their JavaScript jitters using different assumptions. The math I'm doing here is very heavily floating point, but IE happens to optimize more for integer type math. It just so happens, though, that there are other browsers that optimize for floating point or something in between, meaning if I do this, this is a good way to get yourself fired at Microsoft, by the way. I'm going to bring this up here. There, whoops, wrong one. Let's bring it up again. There we are in Chrome. Boom, boom, boom. Yeah, yeah. Now, I want you to know, I'm not digging an IE. I love IE. I really do. But, again, Google has made different assumptions in their JITting engine. In IE10, I showed this to the IE team. They're a great bunch of folks. In IE10, they've already changed some of their optimizations to make it faster. And by the way, if you're a browser vendor, you can build benchmarks that make your browser look faster than any other. It is absolutely true that IE9, in its use of GPU, in some scenarios, makes it the fastest browser under the sun. But what I want you to be aware of is this. Just because it's HTML5 doesn't mean it's going to work the same way in every browser, nor will it necessarily perform the same way. It is important for you to test in all the browsers that you want to support, and especially to detect when there are going to be very, very high degrees of variation in the performance, as you see here. But let me show you an application that I think is even a more interesting use of the location API, or not the location, the Canvas API. Now, this particular app called Photo Finish actually uses two big features of HTML5, the Canvas API and the File API. IE9 supports the Canvas API, but not the File API, so I'm going to need to run this in some other browser. So let's go over to IE10, where you find support for all sorts of HTML5 features, and just run it there. Now, here's what this app allows me to do. At the top, you see an HTML input type equals file control. When I click this Browse button, the browser will pop up an open file dialog and let me load an image. I'm going to use an image of my daughter. Now, this is an old picture. She is a freshman in college right now, and if she knew that I had her picture up on the screen right now, she would probably be very angry at me. But notice those red eyes there. Those are very, very bad-looking eyes. Those are not what her eyes really look like, so I may want to fix that. How about this, folks? I'll click there. And if I were running on a touch device, which I will be doing in my Metro session this afternoon with a Metro port of this, I fix those red eyes. Before Canvas, I could never build these kinds of applications in HTML. But what's cool now, all I'm doing is loading that image using the HTML5 file API to read its contents. I'm drawing the image to a canvas, sensing mouse clicks, and when I see a mouse click occur, I run a little red eye reduction algorithm on the pixel under the cursor and in an area surrounding it. Now, in HTML5 today, there is no way for me to save that edited image. There's no way in HTML5 to pop up, say, a save file dialog. That's one of the reasons if you're building Metro applications in HTML, porting from HTML5 to Metro is very easy. Everything, for the most part, just works. But then what you'll find is Metro adds all that stuff that HTML5 doesn't have that you really need to turn it into a real application. So in the Metro session later today, Again, I'll show you a Metro port of this same app, and we will be able to save the edited images. So I could go on and on about Canvas, but those are just a few of the things that you can do with it. Now, what's next? What else is really new and exciting with HTML5? How about web workers? Let me ask you this. Did you ever think the day would come when we could write true multi-threaded code in JavaScript? Perhaps the more important question is it really a good idea to let JavaScript programmers write multi-threaded code? Well, I think it is. I think it is, and I'll tell you why. Almost all of us are running multi-core machines today. And if we're going to build real applications in JavaScript, we need to be able to leverage those cores. And the only way you can do that is to get extra threads going. Web workers is an HTML5 specification / feature that tells us how to do multi-threading in JavaScript. Now, it's really cool, and it's pretty smart in that when you create a web worker, it doesn't necessarily create a new thread in the operating system. What all browsers do is they use the thread pooling API built into the OS so that a programmer who doesn't know what he or she is doing cannot bog that CPU down with too many threads. What's most interesting about this API, I think, is how you do thread synchronization. If you've ever done multi-threaded coding before, you know it's easy to create a thread. What's hard about multi-threading is coordinating the actions of those threads. And that's why the .NET framework has all kinds of synchronization classes like mutexes, critical sections, monitors, locks, semaphores, events, and all of that. Would you believe this API has no synchronization objects? Isn't that a little bit scary? An API that lets us launch threads but doesn't give us a way to coordinate the threads? Well, here's what it does. What they have done, and I think this is brilliant, they've made it so that you don't have to understand threading to write decent multi-threaded code. They've made it impossible for two threads to access the same piece of data so that you don't need thread synchronization mechanisms. In fact, what a web worker can do is very limited. It cannot touch the UI in that page. In fact, a worker runs in a very special context. Normally, our JavaScript code has access to a window object and a document object. In the special context in which these workers run, there is no window object and no document. You can't use jQuery to query the browser DOM in a worker because there is no document to give you access to the DOM. It's really, really smart because the one thing you can do in this worker thread, besides doing computations and a few other things, networking and stuff, is you can post a message back to the UI thread so that if the computations you're doing in the background, on the background thread, so if you want to show the results to the user, you just post a message back to the UI thread and let it update the UI for you. Real quickly here, but we've got 23 minutes left and still a lot to cover. Here's how you create a thread, so to speak, in HTML5. You new up a worker object, and you pass into it the URL of the JavaScript file containing the code that you want to execute on a background thread. You can, from that background thread, post messages back to the thread that created you, typically the application's UI thread. All you do in the background thread, or the worker, is call postMessage. And then if you want to actually receive that message up in the UI thread, you register a handler for message events, as I'm doing right here. It's also possible for the thread that created the worker to pass messages down to the worker. They can exchange information two ways. I can, for example, after creating the worker, call postMessage on it to send a message down to that worker. And if in that worker I want to receive and respond to the messages that are being sent to me, then in the worker's code, in that JavaScript file that I pass to worker's constructor, I do this. I register a handler for message events. Now, another thing, before I show you an example, I want you to be aware of is that if an unhandled exception occurs in a worker, the results can be catastrophic. That's why when you create a worker, you always want to add a handler for error events fired from it. Because what the browser does for you if an unhandled exception occurs in that background thread is it fires an error event on the main thread in the application. This way you know that something has gone wrong. You can get some information about what went wrong. In fact, quite a lot of information about what went wrong. And if you want, you can warn the user that something went wrong. Now, there's a lot more I could say For example, passing data in those calls to post message, you can pass basically anything you want. Browsers are constantly evolving to make that as efficient as possible. I'm going to show you an example where I'm passing massive amounts of data between threads. And depending on what browser I run it in, sometimes that, in fact, today, the data is always being passed by value, so copies are being made. But one of the very, 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 very latest additions to the HTML5 family of specifications is an addition to the Web Worker spec that provides ways to pass large amounts of data by reference. Chrome version 17 is the only browser that supports that yet, but again, this is constantly evolving and it's getting better and better the whole time. Now here is the example I want to show you of multithreading in JavaScript. A few moments ago, I showed you that Mandelbrot example. And you can imagine that I'm consuming quite a lot of CPU time generating those pixelated images, pixel by pixel. Wouldn't it be nice if, since I'm running on a four-core machine here, if I could take advantage of all four of those cores? Wouldn't it be nice if I could get four threads going, assign each thread a quarter of that browser window, and let each thread in parallel do all the pixel computations it's responsible for? I should be able to get that final fractal image up faster, right, by leveraging those cores. Let's see if it works. So I'm going to go run this thing in Chrome. We'll fire it up here. I call this one multi-Mandelbrot, by the way, right here. And IE9 does not support workers anyway, so IE10 does, by the way. But I'll run this in Chrome, since we've seen Chrome is pretty cool with these workers. And when I run it here, if you look very quickly, you'll see that when image is painted onto the screen, it's actually coming up in one quadrant at a time. Let me click around some and see. Can you see it there? It's subtle, but it's actually coming in one quadrant at a time. Let me show you what I'm doing here really quickly. And again, the whole point is to leverage the multiple cores on multiple core machines. Let's go take a quick look inside that multi-mandelbrot.html. Pretty simple stuff here. What I'm doing is, when this application starts up, my main thread, my UI thread, is creating four image data objects, one for each quadrant of the display. It then creates four workers, which results in up to four new threads being created in this process. It registers a handler for the message events fired from each worker, and then it fires a message down to each worker, basically telling that worker what quadrant it's responsible for and passing it a reference to that image data object. If you look over in my Mandelbrot.js file, whose URL I'm passing to the worker constructor, that's where you find the code that actually does the pixel computations. And once that quadrant has been computed, you'll see the thread calling post message to send the results back up to the UI thread. So the UI thread isn't doing a lot of work. It's just firing up the workers, telling them to go do their thing, and waiting for them to message it. Since the UI thread can only do one thing at a time, even if all four of those workers were to finish their computations at exactly the same time and all post message at the same time, the UI thread can only actually dequeue and process those messages one at a time. That's why you'll always, if you look closely, see that screen painted one quadrant at a time. But that's workers. Yes, it's true. We can do multi-threading in JavaScript now. And it is the easiest and most foolproof multi-threaded programming model I've ever seen. What else can we find to play with in HTML5? What about web storage? Hey, one of the things that will drive you crazy about HTML is, if you're going to try to use it to build real applications, where are you going to store data? I mean, isn't it perfectly reasonable to think that an application might want to store data on that client machine rather than encoded in cookies or something like that? There's a specification in the HTML5 family called the Web Storage Spec, which actually defines two different ways for an application to do that. It gives us local storage and session storage. Session storage, most of us don't care about. What we write into session storage is stored on the client, but it's not persisted, so it goes away when the browser session ends. However, what we write into local storage is persisted in different places on the hard disk by different browsers, so that it survives browser restarts, machine restarts, etc. It's the closest you come today in HTML5 to being able to write data out to a hard disk. By the way, I won't cover it here, there's a separate specification called the IndexedDB that allows you to store structured data. It's newer, 6 months ago, the support for it was spotty. It's getting better every day with every release of the new browsers, and IE10 is going to support it. But let me show you local storage. API-wise, local storage is pretty simple. It's like a dictionary. So when you need to store data in your app, whether it's something simple like a language preference or something more complex like a generated fractal image, you write an item, a name value pair, into local storage. You access local storage through the local storage property of the window object. I'm showing here how to write in a simple string, a language preference, and later pull that string back out using the index that you specified. Now, you can only store name value pairs, but since in an HTML5 browser, you can call json.stringify to JSON encode anything, even very complex objects, you can actually store anything you want in here. Two things to be aware of, however. Most browsers do limit the amount of data you can write into local storage, the same way Silverlight likes to limit the amount of data you write into isolated storage. Why? We don't want a malicious application to be able to fill that user's hard disk up. The HTML5 specification recommends, and I do mean recommends, that's the word that it uses, that browser vendors implement a 5 megabyte per origin spec. Now, that per origin is key. That doesn't mean every application has a 5 megabyte quota. There's no such thing as an application, technically, in HTML5, whereas on a Windows phone, for example, every application has a unique ID, and all storage written out by a Windows phone app is scoped by that ID. There is no way to do that in HTML5, so scoping occurs per origin. That means if you work for a big company and you have 100 HTML5 apps all deployed at, say, www.apple.com, the combined amount of data that all those apps can write to local storage on a given machine is 5 megabytes. Now, some browsers like Chrome give you browser-specific extensions for increasing that limit. Some browsers do not. Even though Chrome is doing it, if you do it in Chrome, it's not going to work anywhere else. The HTML5 web storage specification does not give you any way to find out how much quota you have remaining or to ask for a quota increase. So you must always be prepared for an exception to be thrown when you write to local storage. Something else you should know, by the way, is everything you write to local storage is serialized into a string. When you read it back out, if the data you wrote in was not originally a string, the browser doesn't parse it for you. It's up to you to do it. Let me show you what I mean. If you write something as simple as an integer into local storage, when it comes back out, it is a string. And if you want it to be a number again, you'll need to use something like parseInt. If you were writing, say, an array of integers, like an XY coordinate pair into local storage, you've got to do even more work when you pull it out. This is one reason why a lot of devs today, when they write something into local storage, they'll just go ahead and JSON encode everything, because they know they can just JSON decode it on the way back out. Now, here's one other thing to know. In Firefox, unlike most other browsers, the strings that they stuff into local storage are Unicode strings rather than UTF-8 strings, which means in Firefox, the volume of the data is twice what it is in other browsers. So in some browsers like Firefox, you effectively only get 2.5 megabytes of storage per origin rather than 5 megabytes. That may change in the future. None of us like it, but it is what it is, and you have to know how to deal with it. I'm showing some examples here how to remove items from local storage, but let me just show you a quick example here. So I'm going to run this application here that uses Canvas and local storage to do something kind of interesting. It's called Storage Scribble. And if any of you remember the old Visual C++ Scribble tutorials from years ago, let me do this. Let me clear that out. Here is an app that uses the Canvas API to allow me to scribble. All I'm doing here is tracking mouse movements and using the Canvas API to connect every point that the mouse traverses with a line, a path. But the cool thing about it is, not only am I drawing these lines to the canvas, I'm also recording the XY coordinate pairs in local storage, which means I can close my browser, I can close Visual Studio, I can shut down my machine, I can go spend a week in Hawaii, and I can come back, and next time I run that application, boom, all the data is still there. So, for the first time ever, we have a standard and agreed upon means with some limitations to store data persistently on the client side. That's why local storage is one of the most popular features of HTML5 in use today. By the way, unlike cookies, which travel up and down in every request, not only exposing them to bad people, but also increasing the size of those requests, thereby decreasing performance, local storage stays on the client side. The HTML5 spec tells the browser vendor what the API looks like. It does not tell the browser vendor how to store the data. Every browser stores it in a different way, which means what you write into local storage from IE cannot be read by Chrome or vice versa. So you cannot use this to share data between browsers of different types. You can use it to share data between, for example, two instances of IE. So, just be aware of that. Also, don't ever assume that there's any security for the data. Chrome and Firefox make it really easy to see what's in local storage. So, you must always assume that the user will see what you've written there, and if you must store something that's sensitive, you need to encrypt it first so that prying eyes won't see it. Now, what else can we get into here while we're messing with HTML5? How about the file API? Wow. Boy, if there's one thing that HTML has lacked historically, it is the ability to access the file system. That's finally being fixed in HTML5. The file API is a specification. It's actually one of three file system related specifications in HTML5. The file API only describes how to read files. It doesn't address enumerating files or writing to files or anything like that. They should have called it the file reader API, but this was the first and earliest of the file related specifications, and at that point they didn't foresee the need to write to files, so they called this one the file API. What does it do? It describes an API through which HTML5 browsers let you in JavaScript open files in the file system and read them. Now, in no case will HTML5 let you just go out and, without that user knowing it, scan their hard disk and enumerate files and directories and open files. You can only open a file if the user gives you that file, and there are two ways that can happen. You put an input type equals file element in that page, like I did with the Photo Finish app, so the user clicks a button, chooses the file, and hands it to you. Then and only then can you open the file and read its contents. The other possibility, there is a drag and drop API that allows an HTML5 browser or an app running in it to consume files offered by the user through drag and drop. If your UI will do one of those two things, then yes, you can open and read file contents in HTML. Let me show you a couple of examples here of how it works, then we'll look at an application that uses it. So, here I have an input type equals file attribute in my page. The user clicks that browse button, picks a file, and you'll notice I've registered a change event handler for it. Once the user has picked the file, if they pick one, my change event handler fires, and through the target.files property of the event args that's passed in, I get a reference to an HTML5 file object containing information about that file. Now, it's interesting. You'll notice that that file's property is actually an array property. If you want the user to be able to choose multiple files, you can add a multiple attribute to the input element, as I'm doing here. Now the user can choose as many files as they want, and that file's property passed to you identifies all of those files, gives you one HTML5 file object for each file the user provided. What can you do with a file object? One of the things you can do is get certain information about that file. You can get its name, you can get its type. Is it binary? Is it an image? Is it a text file, etc.? You could even get its size and the date it was last modified. That's all the information the browser will expose to you. You can't find out the path of the file, where it was located, what the security attributes are. This is what HTML5 will allow you to find out about the file. But more importantly, once you have that file, you may want to open it and read its contents. And here's how you do that. This specification, the file API specification, describes, among other things, an object called file reader, which provides an API consisting of four simple methods that allow you to read a file. One of those methods is called readasText. All of these methods are asynchronous, by the way. One of the more recent additions to the HTML5 family is a synchronous file API, which can only be called from web workers. Why? We don't ever want you to let you do I/O operations synchronously on the UI thread, because that makes it too easy to write a bad application. Windows 8 Metro does very much the same thing. So here's how I read the contents of a file. I'm assuming it's a text file here, and remember, I can find out for the file object if it is a text file. Notice the call to read as text at the bottom. I first newed up a file reader object, then I called read as text on it, passed in the file object representing the file the user selected. That's an asynchronous call. So before I call read as text, I've registered a handler for the load event that fires from that file reader object once the file has been read. You'll notice I'm using the old JavaScript 1.0 event handling syntax here on event name. That's because, in my experience, if you use add event listener, this does not work reliably in different browsers today. So until that changes, I would recommend you use the syntax I'm using here. If that were an image file instead, in fact, this is what I'm doing in that photo finish app. You don't want to read it as a text file. I call the read as data URL. It goes out, reads the image, and gives me a data URL with the image bits encapsulated in it. You know what a data URL is? Have you seen those? They're huge. Instead of referring to some location on the internet, all for an image, a data URL encapsulates all of that image data right there in the URL. It's pretty amazing. And I'm not showing it, but there are other methods as well. Specifically, there's one named read as array buffer that allows you to just do a generic binary read on a file. Array buffer is something else that's new in HTML5. It is basically an abstract array. It can encapsulate arrays of data, but you can map it to concrete array types to view that array in different ways. You can map it to a UInt8 array to view it as a bunch of bytes, a UInt16 array, for example, to view it as a bunch of 16-bit values. But real quickly here, since we have just under 5 minutes left, that photo finish app I showed you earlier does use the file API in addition to the Canvas API to let you fix those red eyes in the photos. If you look inside it, you'll find that the file handling part of it was pretty simple. So right down here, here is the change handler I've registered for that input type equals file element. When the user selects a file, I grab a reference to it. I make sure it's an image file they've selected. Doesn't make much sense to try to fix red eyes in a text file. Then I new up a file reader object, register a handler for its onload event, and ultimately call read as data URL. If you look at the rest of the code, once that load event fires, I'm taking the data URL given to me, I'm assigning that to an image, then drawing that image onto a canvas so that I can then call get image data on the canvas and get an image data object wrapping those that image's pixels. So a lot of cool stuff right there in one place. I want to use what little remaining time I have to tell you about some exciting new things in HTML5 with regard to networking, beginning with something called XML HTTP request level 2. In fact, since we have 3.5 minutes, let me do this. I'm going to go straight to the last two demos, but first let me show you this. I promised you a URL from which you could download all of these samples, and this is that URL. I'll leave that up there for just a moment, and I'll make sure that that URL is active for several weeks, if not months. The truth is, I'll probably forget about it, and it'll probably be a good 20 years from now. But I'll make sure it's at least available for a couple of months or something. Again, the zip file containing all of the samples that I showed you, plus some. Let me show you these last two samples, and let me ask you a question. If there's one thing you could change about AJAX, what would it be? I'm going to have to run this one in another browser. Let's run it in, I'll just run it in Chrome. What would you change about AJAX if you could change one thing about it? If I were asked that question, I would say I'd like AJAX to be able to go across domain boundaries. Isn't it silly that to use AJAX to call a REST service like Facebook, we have to first go back to a service in our own domain and then bridge out from there? What a waste of network bandwidth. XML HTTP request level 2 is a specification, a feature of HTML5 that is getting a lot of traction now, that makes a lot of improvements to AJAX. But the big thing that it does is it allows you to go across domain boundaries with calls. Now, both the server and the browser have to allow it to happen. They do so by supporting a simple protocol called CORS, cross-origin resource sharing, which has its own specification devoted to it. It's a header-based protocol. Basically, when I make an AJAX call across domain boundaries, the browser, if it supports that, includes an origin header in the request indicating where this data came from. The server, if it will accept that cross-origin request, returns a special response header saying, yeah, I'll take that cross-origin request. There aren't too many real live servers out there in the world today that will respond to that CORS protocol and saying, yes, I'll take cross-origin requests. So I built one in WCF, deployed it on my company's web server back home. What I'm going to do here is find out what the weather is where I live in the southeastern United States. Now, what's significant about this, even though you can't see it from the outside, is I'm not bridging out to a service in my own domain. This is a cross-domain AJAX request. No security had to be turned off in the browser simply because of that CORS protocol. I won't have time to show you the last MO, but the last subject I was going to hit was WebSockets. You've probably heard of them. WebSockets are cool. They've been around. They've been working on the spec for a while, but they also keep finding security vulnerabilities. So some browser vendors are, in one release, they'll have it disabled, then they'll re-enable it in the next. They're currently in the 17th version of the WIRE protocol used. But here's what it is, and it's going to be very significant, I think. There's never been a standard and approved way for a server to push data down to a browser client. WebSockets is a mechanism by which a browser client and a web server can use an HTTP handshake to establish a two-way TCP connection. Not only can that browser client now send raw data up to the web server anytime it wants, anytime that web server wants to push data down, it can do that through that open duplex socket. If you were going to build an application that showed real-time sports scores or stock prices or something like that, any app that needs to push data down to that client and do so efficiently and asynchronously, WebSockets does that. Scott Guthrie is doing a talk, I think, later this afternoon on MVC4 where they have some support for it. I don't know this for a fact, but I bet he will show you that. And with that, I'm out of time. Thank you so much. I hope you've learned a little bit about HTML5.